Fiona McMillan Webster is a science writer with degrees in physics and biophysics. She's written for National Geographic, Forbes, Cosmos Magazine, Australian Geographic, and more, and has been included in several of the best Australian science writing anthologies. In 2016, she was runner-up for the UNSW Bragg Press Prize for science writing, and she was shortlisted for the prize in 2021. Her first book, The Age of Seeds, came out into the world this week. Welcome, Fiona, and congratulations on your beautiful book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on.
It's our pleasure. I guess I'd like to start by asking how you came to write about seeds.
That is actually a very good question. Because there were points when I was writing this, how did this happen? As a science writer, as you know yourself, your story radar is always kind of on. It's a bit like a bowerbird. Sometimes you'll pick these little ideas and put them aside for things that seem like there's more to the story than that, or things that pique your interest. So I have, these folders on my computer where I put down story ideas, or on my phone. As I've been doing more and more science writing, I think sometimes ideas, you'll come across something as you're doing some writing and also take some of that. I might come back to that because it might be part of another story, but there's something about it that goes, there might be something really interesting here. I think I listened to Neil Gaiman say once that that where you get your ideas from, he used to sort of make a joke whenever somebody would ask that. But then I think one day he said that his kids' primary school classroom, and one of the kids asked that, and he said, "Well, I can't, make fun of this little kid." And he realized it's actually the most important question. And he said for him it was confluence, where you get different ideas coming together. You might see something over here, something over there, and then just one day it kind of comes together. And I think that's kind of what happened here a little bit. A few different ideas I'd encountered them, and they just kind of came together. I suppose it probably started when I was writing an article for Cosmos Magazine a few years ago about these strains of wheat that some scientists were working on to sort of understand how well they took in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. These are grasses, and just to understand why some grasses and some plants were better at taking in carbon dioxide and using that for growth and others weren't so good at it. And as we're going along in this conversation, the researcher mentioned, he said, "Oh, the Vavilov seeds." And I was like, "The what?" And he said, "The Vavilov seeds." And, everybody knows the Vavilov seeds, and I've, of course, never heard of these. And he told me this kind of an aside story that just was both fascinating and sad, but also just really interesting. And it was about a man named Nikolai Vavilov. He was a Russian scientist, a Russian botanist, back during the Stalin era. And he went around the world and collected all these seeds from different parts of the world. His goal was to find out where our crops came from. And he was just fascinated with seeds. And he collected these seeds and created this seed bank in Leningrad, which was Leningrad at the time. And it was... it was kind of the first time that many seeds had been collected and cataloged in one place before. It was like the world's biggest, first real big seed bank of global seeds. And it was part of his journey in finding out where our crops came from. And he had a really good reason for doing this. He wanted to prevent famines, and he wanted to find crops that were good in all different kinds of conditions, because conditions change. And if there's a drought, then a drought's coming, then you can bring in the drought-tolerant varieties and things like that, to allow farmers and agriculture in general to be able to adapt. So I put this story in the back of my mind, especially because it had, he ran afoul of some of the political machinations that were going on in Stalinist Russia at the time. And ultimately, when World War II happened and the Nazis marched on Leningrad, there was a siege there that lasted at least three Russian winters, and the seed bank scientists basically stayed in protected seeds, and a number of them starved to death in order to save these seeds because they knew how important these varieties of seeds were. And they effectively gave their lives for this. And the good news is it wasn't in vain. These seed lines that were collected way back when are actually still being used by researchers today, and they're providing some really wonderful discoveries. So that story was like, wow, that's an amazing story that these researchers went through, and also what happened to Vavilov himself in Stalinist Russia. But also, it kind of got me thinking about the importance of seeds and where, I suppose, where our food comes from, how precarious that all of our food is coming from, most of the food on the planet is coming from seeds. And I started to wonder, well, what does happen if we lose these varieties of seeds? And I didn't really understand the extent to which we're dependent on a very small number of seeds for our food. And so that kind of sat in the background, and I was very interested in that story. And then I came across some other stories as, you know, just going along daily life and science writing, which is one of the wonderful things about science writing, is there's always these interesting stories coming up. And I would hear these stories about these very, very old date palm seeds. And they're 2,000 years old, these reports of these seeds that had been found at these archaeological sites, planted, and they actually sprouted. And then, and this is where I think the confluence really came into play, was I myself was trying to plant this old packet of sunflower seeds that I found in my house. And they were only a few years out of date, but I didn't really understand, oh, seeds are seeds, right? They're basically like tiny little rocks until you need them to do something. And this is sort of my non-botanist, non-gardener kind of viewpoint. I just didn't really think about seeds. And I think a lot of us don't really sit and think about seeds very much. They're there, they're all around us. We rely on them pretty much to live. But to really understand what they need from us and how they grow and all these things is not something at the forefront of a lot of people's minds, and it wasn't in mine. So I planted these seeds, and there was like some 70-odd seeds in this packet. And, you know, oh, I'll do a lovely little experiment with my daughter. We'll plant some. It'll be just this gorgeous little sort of at-home science experiment to see which ones grow. And nothing grew, like not one. And I thought, okay, like, I know I'm not a green thumb, but this is some, you know, this is some new territory for me to completely kill an entire pack of seeds. And that had me wondering, well, how come you have these 2,000-year-old date palm seeds that live 2,000 years, yet you've got this pack of sunflower seeds that doesn't last on my dresser for very long? And that really brought me into the world of seed longevity. And that completely blew my mind, because I thought, oh, I'll just do a bit of a Google search and somebody will have the answer to seed longevity, and I'll just read that and that'll satisfy my curiosity. But as with a lot of good stories, the more I unfolded, the more layers there were, the more interesting it became, and the more I found out that we don't actually know everything about seed longevity, about why some seeds live a really, really, really long time and other seeds don't. And then going through this, it made that whole idea of food security even seem even more precarious, because not only are we reliant on these seeds, we are reliant on seeds that do not live very long from one generation to the next. And by very long, some of them might at a stretch last a couple decades if they're doing really well, but a lot of them might only last a couple of years. And sunflower seeds, for example, that's an oil seed crop and a lot of people rely on them, only last a couple of years. So it just sort of made me realize how important it is, all these seed banks in the world and what people are doing. And that's kind of the long story as to how I dove into this. And it's just, yeah, every time I open some new box in this whole story. It just was more and more interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It kind of makes me think too about all of the apocalyptic fiction that we've seen or read, and how nobody's really talking about, you know, how we survive if not only the crops go, but the seeds. What happened if the seeds go? Or I was also thinking about this when I was reading your book about, you know, sort of travel to Mars or travel outside of, you know, the, when we're talking about really long time periods, and seeds are going to be a major issue for these, you know.
Absolutely. And it's something that's why NASA is doing a lot of research, and the European Space Agencies and other space agencies around the world are doing these kind of research projects on how well seeds withstand spaceflight. Because you're not only dealing with long period of times, potentially, you're also dealing with you know, turbulence and radiation outside the protective layer of the Earth's magnetic field. So there are a lot of considerations for, like, we have this idea that we'll be able to go to Mars and plant crops, but whether or not we're able to get these seeds to survive that length of time, and probably they will, but they will have to have done these experiments and done these studies, so they know how well to protect them from solar winds, solar gamma radiation, solar flares, and they have to protect the astronauts, but they also have to protect anything biological on board, just to make sure things get there in one piece and can then germinate at the other side. And then you've got the issue of soil once you get there. And so it's, I find that really fascinating. And for anything about these, you know, space colonization journeys, anything you take is going to have to be very small, very light. Getting everything off. You don't want to take a forest off planet Earth. You want to take the seeds. It's a lot easier to take the seeds. But they'll have to be doing all these things and understand what conditions those seeds need on the other side, and seed longevity is definitely a big part of that. Mm-hmm. But it's also, really important back here on Earth, more than I think we realize.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do places like the seed banks preserve seeds for the future?
There's a few different kinds of seed banks, or it's when I came across these different types of seed banks, some would call themselves gene banks rather than seed banks. Some would call themselves purely seed banks. So you'll see these different terms used. And usually the gene banks are ones that do more than seeds, because seeds are basically just a way that a plant preserves its genetic code for them, you know, to pass along. So seeds are really great ways of having these little mobile genetic units kind of out there. But not all plants have seeds that preserve very well. So there will be plants that where they take tissue cultures and have to preserve that. Or maybe they do have seeds, but yeah, they're just not that great at doing that sort of long period of time. So there's the gene banks, and then there's purely the seed banks. And then there's for those seed banks, they are very limited. Where they are doing seed storage, they're quite limited to seeds that are called orthodox seeds, which are seeds that actually tolerate the whole drying down and then freezing process. Because when you prepare these seeds for these gene banks, seed banks like the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is up in the Arctic Circle, that's a dedicated seed bank. They don't do other sorts of tissue culture or anything there. So the only seeds that can really be stored there are the ones that are quite happy to be dried down and quite happy to be frozen. And that does mean that you are filtering out a bunch of other seeds that actually don't like that. Take, for example, you know, there's a number of tropical rainforest species. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it. They like the wet. They like the warmth. they didn't really evolve to be, you know, deal with long, long, long periods of drought and dryness that these other seeds do. Now, fortunately, a lot of our crop seeds that we rely on for food do have orthodox seeds. They produce orthodox seeds, so that's lucky. We can preserve those. But yeah, what they do is they will, for the ones, so the seeds that can tolerate it, they will dry them down to very, very, very low humidity. And then they will freeze them, and then they store them in these sort of foil packets and put them away. And that's where seed longevity comes into the picture too, because they don't know already one packet of seeds how long it's going to live, how long those seeds are going to last in there. They can't predict just by looking at, if you just look at a seed, you don't really know if it's alive or dead, just like me with my sunflowers. It is a problem in these big seed banks too. And so the last thing you want to be doing is preserving dead seeds, right? So you want to make sure that you're always got live seeds in there. So the only way to really do it, so you can't sort of knock on the pack and like, everyone okay in there? You have to actually just take a few out and plant them and see how many of those that you took out actually survive or actually grow. And it constantly has to be doing that. But then at the same time, you don't want to use up all your seeds in testing. So there's this kind of balance where they're constantly having to refresh the seeds in these things, test them, refresh, test. And that's why understanding how long seeds live and being able to predict that would be really helpful for these major seed banks around the world. So that's where the seed longevity science is really going to be important.
Yeah. Now, there's so many fascinating aspects to this book. I guess one of the questions that I've had, knowing that you and I both come from scientific backgrounds, mm-hmm. but we've kind of ended up writing into different spaces from where we started.
Yeah.
So did you find that you fell back in any way on your scientific training, or in the writing of this book, did you find that you relied on other skills or aspects of your science, or was it altogether different from what you thought it was going to be?
Well, I knew going in that I'm not a botanist. and my houseplants can attest to that. And I haven't always been the best plant carer, but my PhD is in biophysics and my undergrad is in physics. So in that sense, I didn't fully expect a great deal of my prior research experience to come into play. However, it did in some chapters. So in some chapters, not so much. In other chapters, very much so. Seed longevity, for example, is very much a biophysics problem. And so for that, having that background in biophysics and understanding how biomolecules interact at that sort of atomic scale and why, the nature of glasses, because seeds, when they get dried down to that degree, the orthodox seeds are actually quite glassy, and they adopt this kind of, there's a lot of glass physics to get your head around there. So that was really great for me. I could actually go back to my my experience in biophysics and understand some of that, but that was only one small part of the book. I think for me, it was a lot of exploration, which is exactly why I like science writing. I didn't do my degree in evolutionary biology, but I love evolutionary biology. And so anything that's got that sort of side to it, any story with an evolutionary biology aspect, I'm really interested in. Not because I feel like I get to hold forth on it, but rather I get to learn something. So anything that has that opportunity just to learn and just have that kind of delight from discovery appeals to me. And in the writing of that, I like that because then I get to hopefully convey that sense of wonder to the audience. And I realize that it's okay that I don't come at this as a seasoned botanist, but rather sort of telling my audience things, but rather bringing the audience with me as I go on a journey. And that was the kind of approach I decided to take with this. And another writer, Rebecca Gates, and does that really well in her book Fathoms on Whales, where she says right up front, I'm, you know, not a whale biologist, but look at these things I've discovered. And that sense of like being with her as she discovers things is, I think, works really well. So I was kind of inspired by that.
Yeah, and that actually reminds me too. I love the voice that you have in this book. It's not dry. It feels very curiosity forward. And actually there are ways that you almost kind of, I don't know, take the piss out of yourself sometimes as you're writing, which I really enjoy. And I have one here, that I highlighted. And if you can bear to listen to, sorry, a sentence quoted back at you, I just wanted to share this because, I'll just start. If you trace a finger along China's coastline, beginning in the south at the border with Vietnam and ending at the border with North Korea, you'll find yourself making a large, languorous S, right? So I read that and I'm like, oh, that is beautiful. That is like the kind of thing that you hear on science programs. Like, it's got you right there. And then the next sentence. Granted, it is a rather bottom-heavy S and it leans to the right, but you get the idea. This is the kind of beautiful, friendly energy that pervades this book all the way through. It's beautifully written, but then you also know, I don't know, you have this kind of smile as you're saying things, which I really enjoy. And I wonder, do you naturally write like this, or was this something that you had to kind of work towards?
I think that kind of just comes out. I guess I've always been a bit self-depreciating, kind of humor a little bit. If I see something funny, I actually have to hope that it's appropriate to say that thing, or I'll see something like, oh, that's funny, and then but I'm like, well, this is my book, so I guess I can just throw that in. And of course, knowing the right places to do that and where to do it, where things do need to be very serious, but also where things need to be light. That was part of the enjoyment of the writing process, is being able to, dive into that and basically it is playing with words, and that's part of what I love about writing. I love words. I love playing around with them. I don't want to take myself too seriously in certain parts where I'm not presenting as though it's like I'm not a geographer. I was just the only 5 minutes old going, oh, it looks like an S. I'm not sort of trying to instruct the audience on, how to do it, but rather just to say, oh, hey, it looks a bit like this. So it's, there it's kind of fun to play with that. But then there are obviously other chapters where things are very serious and the stakes are high, and it's great there to be able to use words that will have that emotional impact, that I hopefully relayed the emotional impact that I had when I heard about these stories, and being able to again bring the reader with me, so that if something did happen that was very sad or very tragic or worrisome about the future, I kind of want that emotion to be shared as well. But then, yes, there are other things where I think discovery, interest in science, there is a playful side to it, that curiosity. And I myself need that playfulness, I suppose. Just delighting in the diversity of seed shapes and things like that, and just being able to kind of dive into that. I think it was wonderful sort of getting my kids involved in certain parts, because they themselves are not, they're not going to take it too seriously, but they're going to just dive in and go, yeah, this seed looks ridiculous. This one looks like, party hat. This one looks like this. Where it's not trying to be too dry. And I think communication of science, I think I've read somewhere once, I'm trying to remember where, Yeah, it was Yellowleaf Douglas's book on writing. It's a wonderful little book. It's a tiny little thing, but it really changed a lot of the way I write. It's called The Reader's Brain. And she points out that the complexity of the subject matter shouldn't be reflected in the complexity of the writing. So in a way, in places that where the complexity of the subject matter was like really already a lot, it's better to have the more simpler, straightforward writing because there's already enough complexity. But in other places where you kind of want to see something that looks simple on the surface, but you want to sort of show that it's actually really wonderful and more complex and maybe a bit poetic, then you could, you know, sort of flip it a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and I love that, actually. I mean, I think that for me personally as a writer, that's something that I could use some more practice with, I think, because, I mean, I think in my science writing, I tend more towards the sort of let's simplify this a little bit, or like let's find the most direct way to say, you know, this, to convey this information. But when it comes to the like the fiction side, especially in my first draft, I often go a little bit too poetic and it's like, what am I actually trying to say? So I really love that.
And I've done that too. And that's what drafts are for, right? Because you need to enjoy it. Well, I mean, if we're not enjoying writing this stuff, then why are we doing it? So it's important to, you know, play around with words and you don't know what kind of beautiful line will come out if you don't play like that and see what comes out. And I think, and that's just all part of the, you know, the trial and error in writing. And I've written fiction, not yet published, but I've had that kind of struggle sometimes where I was trying so hard to be mysterious or something like that, or I think I made it too murky or something like that. But that's where all that work on practicing creative writing was all part of this, because science writing, at least science writing for a book like this, it is creative, it's narrative. And that sort of raises an important point about how we convey science, is we have to do sometimes, yeah, you need to just get straight to the facts, you know, this is COVID-19, this is what it does, this, you know, that kind of thing. But there are, when it comes to some big issues that are where you want to just draw people in and just get their attention, then sort of holding forth and just throwing facts at them doesn't do the trick. You need to, I think narrative and storytelling is a very pro-social thing. I mean, it's part of what it is to be human. So connecting through story and narrative is an important part of that. So being able to play in that way and then start to introduce the details is more effective. And I don't usually get the chance to do that, but something the size of the book, you do. And that's so a short press release or a short article, you don't always get to play around like that. But with a book, you have time to sort of pace it out and tell stories. And so, yeah, hopefully it works.
And do you feel it's going to be difficult to go back to the shorter forms now that you've had this like long loungy experience?
It was. I've written one thing since. And it was tricky to get it all in, and that even had like something like a 4,000 or a 3,000 word limit. No, what was it? Something ridiculous. It's something that I would have once thought was a long word limit, and now it's like, oh, I gotta get all the ideas in there at once. Luckily, that one was probably a good one to ease back in, because it was by the Gropius Bauhaus Journal, which is associated with the Bauhaus. The art museum over in the Gropius Bauhaus Museum in Germany, and they wanted something kind of artsy and a bit more narrative and prosy, so it kind of was, but it had a short word length, so it's kind of probably a good stepping stone back into writing shorter pieces. But that was one of the reasons I wanted to do a book, was because in doing shorter spaces, I always wanted to just keep going and unravel things and see where different threads led. So that was one of the beautiful parts of being able to do this finally, is to do that deep dive.
And when we've talked previously, you've mentioned how much you enjoyed the history of the stories here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The history of the historical stories?
Yes.
Just as much as I love things with evolutionary biology, I'm a sucker for looking at history in a new light or learning about different things in history that I didn't know about before. And so the interesting thing was, because seeds are so important to our world, our livelihoods, you know, our security and, you know, what we eat, our daily calories, they're never far from any big conflict or big issue or big dramatic story in history. And so in telling the story of the Judean date palm seeds that were found in just near the Dead Sea, it sort of couldn't tell that without giving it its historical context to really kind of underscore how old these were, to sort of highlight this is around 79 AD, and this is when the Romans were, they'd just done I'm just trying to think the right word. So around 70 AD was when the Roman siege of Jerusalem took place. And so this was that time period. It just seems so ages ago. So the idea that there's a seed that was alive when the Romans were surrounding Jerusalem, and it's still alive, and the plant that, you know, produced is still alive today, that just blew my mind. So I loved having that kind of context there. But also, I think the cultural history and the cultural connections that seeds have are incredibly important. And that's one of the reasons I dedicate the last chapter to seeds and culture. And to show that you can't sort of take seeds out of history, they're actually intricately woven into history. In fact, so many wars are waged because of food resources, and they still are. And there's also food and seeds become a tool of war in many cases. And so I love being able to sort of highlight that connection there. But again, also just getting to learn about, you know, the Roman siege of Jerusalem, the understanding how the Romans surrounded Masada, the fortress of Masada, and by the Dead Sea, understanding that the seeds that they found at Masada, but then also in the surrounding area, were in some of the same caves that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Like, just that, it's just that's so ancient, but then now you've got this living tree that was essentially born, really, all that time ago. Was just amazing to me. And then, of course, the Babylon story, having an understanding of Stalinist Russia to really understand how politics and science clashed back then. And
it really felt like those alternative facts kind of philosophy that.
Yeah. It goes to show that this is not the first time, and it won't be the last, that we have science and political agendas clashing. It's probably always going to happen, but it's also why we can't just, you know, let the guard down and assume that everyone will just accept science as fact, because that's not necessarily the case, as we see in our modern-day political arena. So it's... seeing it play out in that way. So just for the listeners who haven't yet read that section, so Nikolai Vavilov, as I mentioned, was a botanist in Stalinist Russia, and he just wanted to collect his seeds and understand where crops came from, and he was the person through this work who figured out where that most of the crops had, many of the crops rather, had originated in the Fertile Crescent which is in the Middle East, for the area between northern Egypt, the kind of arcs up near Turkey, and then down through to Mesopotamia, ancient Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq. So this that was not understood until Vavilov came along. He just wanted to collect the seeds and understand genetics, and would have been very happy doing that for the rest of his life. But the world events came in, and so we had Stalin rise to power, and Stalin wanted to be surrounded by people who were agreed with him and didn't disagree with him. And you had these political ideas that somehow I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, or how to condense it, because it's so complex what was going on. But essentially what you had is these political ideas that came up against genetics, and genetics was almost seen as a bourgeois, Western, British thing, but that was something that these elites over in Britain did, and was therefore not in line with Stalinist Russia's idea of you know, sort of the that you could sort of mold a peasant into greatness, and that kind of idea that everybody was supposed to work together in this way versus genetics over there. And it was a complete warping of what genetics was, and a willful misunderstanding of it. But it was still something that became popular. And so you had somebody, people like Vavilov, who stood up against it. But sadly, he was up against too many political foes, and he was ultimately arrested and he was imprisoned. And sadly, he did starve to death in Stalinist prison. And around the same time that his colleagues were in the siege of Leningrad, and they were also dying to protect the seeds. They pretty much died for what they believed in, and they didn't want to see Russia go the way it was going. And it does hold a very important lesson for us, that ideology will come up against scientific principles, and it's very important to push back against that whenever it does.
Absolutely. So going back a little bit to the writing, were there parts that were particularly challenging for you in writing this book, do you think?
Yes, I think the narrative sections were, as we talked about, was enjoyable, and being able to dive into the stories. And sometimes the stories did just kind of write themselves. I mean, the adventures that Vavilov went on, you just had to sort of just be talking about him, and it was sounding good because he just did some amazing things.
You can feel that too. It's there are definitely fictional elements, like fiction feeling elements. In those stories.
Sometimes I was reading about some of his adventures, and I was like, is this even real? He's like Indiana Jones. So that stuff was easier to write, and anything where there was that kind of story, maybe that's probably why I gravitate towards them. I think the more difficult chapters to write were the ones on food security, global hunger, climate change, the loss of biodiversity. Those were hard to write because it was confronting. And I think Naomi Klein is right. Like it's you want to look away, but it's only by kind of looking at the problem and realizing that it is bad, but it's not insurmountable. And so I think that was still difficult to write about the state of global hunger and why it was decreasing and is now unfortunately going backwards. Understanding how much of the world is, how much of the habitats are being destroyed, mainly for farming and grazing and things like that. And also trying to find a balance between making sure everyone gets fed, but also not destroying all these ecological habitats in the process. Understanding that there has to be a balance, and trying to figure out if there can be a balance was kind of it was confronting to dive into those numbers and to kind of feel that, you know, that gut punch whenever you read these really serious numbers about the loss of species and the, you know, the loss of habitats, but also the worry about, you know, how many children are going undernourished every year. And knowing that there has to be some way we can have a nourished human population, but not at the expense of the world's biodiversity, and figuring out what the way forward is. So that was, yeah, that was confronting. But I wanted this not to be a book that was meant to just deliver all these miserable facts and make people just go, oh, never mind, I guess I'll just curl up in the corner and I want it to be something where people see, okay, these are these big problems, but they are solvable, you know, by with crop breeding, with the right policies. And I don't have all the answers, or I even pretend to know all the answers, but showing that at least for certain aspects of these problems, that there are people working on them. That was the wonderful thing about this book, was actually getting to speak to people around the world who are working on these problems every day. This is what they live and breathe, and they are looking for these drought-resistant species of wheat and these, you know, flood-resistant species of rice and varieties. And in order that they can then bring these into crop breeding programs so that they can be available when you have, as the climate's changing. And this is meant to go not instead of or in lieu of all the efforts to combat climate change, but to be part of the adaptation. And same too with the biodiversity and the seed banks that are working on saving seeds of incredibly rare, threatening near extinct species, is not to just go, okay, well, it's all right, we'll just have all the seeds in the seed bank and just whatever happens outside doesn't matter. And nobody was ever, you know, reporting that that should be the case. The seed bank managers I spoke to were passionate conservationists and passionate about preserving and preventing the loss of these species. But they also knew that they needed a safety net to work, so that they'd have a safety net in concert with the conservationists, so that you could hopefully have a habitat that was, reinvigorated, that these seeds could then go back into and then start to rebuild those ecosystems again. But you need the seeds to do that, but the seeds alone aren't enough. So it's all part of the same thing. And I like those stories of hope in there as well, to see people saving, like just doing what they could to save one species, you know? And if they're doing that for that, they're doing it for lots of other ones as well. So it was, for me, I came away with quite a lot of hope by seeing these people doing what they're doing every day. So yeah, so it was hard, but also hopeful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And actually, I think that is a beautiful place to finish up today, with that feeling of hope. And thank you so much, Fiona, for joining us on the Science Right Now podcast.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to engage with your book, and I hope you have a lot of fun with all of the stuff that comes next now that it's out in the world.
And I'm glad the little puppy was like sleeping the whole way through that. So that was
yes. No, you have to tell it. You have to tell everyone about how you got a new puppy the week that your book was launched.
It wasn't exactly planned, but just, you know, things happened. We had promised a puppy to the kids a while ago, and just this little girl became available, and she's just beautiful. She's mostly golden retriever, a bit of collie. And they, that she was meant to be picked up on Sunday. So I now was going into my book launch week with a crazy little puppy in the house, and she's been wonderful and probably a good distraction.
I think so. Yeah, but that's always a good thing. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider sharing or leaving us a review. It really helps young podcasts like ours reach more listeners. We love to hear from you on email, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And you can find more writers and writing inspired by science on our website, ScienceRightNow.com. Science Right Now is sponsored by the Australia Council for the Arts, hosted by Amanda Niehaus and Jessica White, and produced by Taylor Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.